Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba made an impassioned plea at Thursday's NATO meeting in Brussels.
My agenda is very simple. It has only three items on it. It's weapons, weapons, and weapons.
Plus, the United Nations removes Russia from its Human Rights Council.
In favor, 93. Against, 24. Abstentions, 58.
And later in the program, a preview of a multimedia exhibit highlighting the work of a 19th century Ukrainian artist and poet. Today is Thursday, April 7th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm VOA Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman, in for Steve Miller. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba on Thursday dismissed the reluctance of some countries to fulfill Ukrainian requests for arms due to fears of being drawn into the conflict with Russia, saying that by giving Ukraine what it needs, Ukrainians will do the fighting so no one else has to.
My agenda is very simple. It has only three items on it. It's weapons, weapons, and weapons. We are confident that the best way to help Ukraine now is to provide it with all necessary to contain Putin and to defeat Russian army in Ukraine, in the territory of Ukraine, so that the war does not spill over further. And I call on all allies to put aside their hesitations, their reluctance, to provide Ukraine with everything it needs, because as weird as it may sound, but today weapons serve the purpose of peace.
He spoke in Brussels alongside NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg ahead of a meeting with NATO foreign ministers. Joining us now from London is VOA correspondent Henry Ridgewell. Henry, the Ukrainian foreign minister pleaded for weapons, weapons, weapons today. Any indication if the NATO ministers responded yes, yes, yes?
Well, there is a positive response to the Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba's request in NATO. They do want to supply more weapons to Ukraine. They do want them to prevail against the Russian forces that have invaded Ukraine. But the key issue here is all about timing and the level of weaponry that is being provided. We know, for example, that individual NATO member states, the United States, has given $100 million, an additional $100 million worth of military aid last week in the form of Javelin anti-tank missiles. We know the Czech Republic is giving tanks and infantry vehicles. Britain is hosting a delegation of Ukrainian military officials today at a training ground in Britain, showcasing some of the capabilities that they want to offer Ukraine. But so far, the Ukrainians' complaint has been that this is all piecemeal and too slow, and that they need a far more systematic and larger scale supply of heavier weapons to take on the Russian forces as they regroup in the east and the south of the country. Now, that would include more higher altitude anti-aircraft missiles, anti-ship missiles to take on some of the Russian vessels in the Black Sea, and also tanks, the likes of which the Czech Republic is starting to supply.
The U.S. alone is, I think, put in upwards of a couple of $1 billion now since Russia invaded Ukraine. And you mentioned some of the contributions from the other NATO members. So it really seems this is about a preferred mix. Not the money.
I think there is a level of understanding that the logistics of this supply of weapons is very difficult, and also within NATO that the supply of heavy weapons, of greater technology, is in danger of possibly provoking, of escalating the conflict with Russia. The Ukrainians are trained in essentially Soviet-era weapons, the weapons that they inherited at the breakup of the Soviet Union that they have continued to import from Russia since the early 1990s. There is a supply of those weapons still available in Europe, among them the ones that the Czech Republic is supplying. There are more to come, but the supply is limited.
You mentioned the Soviet-era equipment, and that has included a request from Kyiv for MiGs. Is that still on the table as far as we know?
every time you speak to officials either in Ukraine or in NATO about this, they say it's not been taken off the table entirely, but it gets back to this issue of escalating the conflict with Russia. The original plan was that Poland had offered its MiG-29s to Ukraine, but it didn't want to be sort of sticking out on its own as the one country that was providing that level of weaponry to Ukraine, which might trigger some kind of response from Russia. So the idea was they would give them to a US airbase in Poland from where Ukrainian fighter pilots could take them into Ukraine. The idea was that Russia would be less likely to retaliate against the United States. But the United States balked at that idea. It's not ready for that level of escalation, ready to supply Ukraine with those. The more that this conflict drags on and the greater the level of apparent atrocities on the ground allegedly carried out by Russian forces, that puts more pressure on the West to take more action.
VOA correspondent Henry Ridgewell in London. Thank you, Henry.
Thanks, Steve.
Germany, according to Der Spiegel magazine, intercepted radio transmissions of Russian soldiers discussing the killings of civilians in the town of Bucha, contradicting Russian propaganda claims of a hoax. We've been discussing on this program images and videos of civilians killed in Bucha emerged earlier this week after Russian forces left the town near Kiev. There are also fears from Ukrainian officials and others that similar massacres have occurred in other cities in Ukraine. Reporter Anna Chernikova was in Irpin earlier today. Anna, thank you for joining us on Flashpoint Ukraine. We've been hearing calls to preserve evidence of the massacre in Bucha and possibly other cities for eventual war crimes trials. Are you hearing of any such activity related to that, Anna?
There's a lot of international organization working here. Ukrainian government is writing down all the crimes that they have found out so far, and they do this in partnership with European partners, this is for sure. But I think that we will have to wait until the final results.
The Russians continue to deny any responsibility, and some officials in Moscow accuse the Ukrainians and others of staging these massacres. How are people in Ukraine reacting when they hear that?
People just started to ignore this because, you know, there is no enough anger just to listen to this absurd things, because if you come here personally and see this and experience this, you can say for sure that this kind of stuff could not be staged. It's something that you cannot just do to prove that someone is wrong. Ukrainians understand and this just cannot be true because they have experienced that and they know exactly who have done it. And they know exactly how Ukrainian army is acting and how Ukrainian army is saving people. Because people here in Irpin and in Bucha, they were crying when Ukrainian army came in, and they were giving them at least some food that they had, even they didn't have enough. This is definitely something that neither Ukrainians, and I'm pretty sure nor the whole world, would believe in.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you.
The United Nations General Assembly has voted to suspend Russia from the Human Rights Council.
Draft resolution A/ES-11/L4 is adopted.
The push for this, led by the United States, resulted in 93 nations voting in favor of it, 24 noes, and 58 countries abstaining. Joining us now on Flashpoint Ukraine to discuss this is VOA's United Nations correspondent, Margaret Bashir. Any surprises among major nations in their votes, Margaret?
Well, a little bit. I would say there were definitely more abstentions, but I think that was expected because it was a really, you know, it's a strong move to evict basically a permanent member of the UN Security Council from the Human Rights Council body. So I think there were a lot of countries that were not comfortable with it. So there were abstentions. For instance, like Mexico abstained, and that surprised me because they've been leading the call in the Security Council for more accountability, for humanitarian access, for ceasefire. You know, they've been very strong on this war.
What sort of pressure did Russia apply on countries before the vote?
The there was a letter that went around, according to diplomats, from the Russians saying that they would see this as kind of a hostile move against them. I don't think that was Mexico's motivation in particular for its abstention. Several countries did say that they felt it was a bit too soon to take this step. And I think they were more in that group because the Human Rights Council has actually mandated a commission of inquiry to look into gross human rights violations in Ukraine, but basically Russian ones. And they've just been appointed, the three experts have just been appointed about, I don't know, 10 days ago now. So some countries were saying, look, we need to wait for them to do their work. You're prematurely acting and you're prejudging the outcome of their work.
What is the practical outcome of this? The UN is frequently criticized for making symbolic declarations that result in little of substance.
Russia is not known for its great human rights record in the first place, and nor, frankly, are several of the other members of the Human Rights Council. Currently, Eritrea, Pakistan, Venezuela, China, these are some of the current members. So not really always a spectacular group on the council. But when they work right and when they work well, the Human Rights Council can, for instance, mandate these commissions of inquiry, fact-finding missions and such, and shine a spotlight on human rights abuses in parts of the world. What the real essence of this is, it just shows that Russia is more isolated here in this multilateral setting at the UN.
After the vote, you spoke with the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. What was her reaction?
Yes, I spoke briefly with Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield, and she said this sends a strong message of support to the Ukrainians. It sends a strong message about human rights. And to those who said it's too early to take this action, she said, why should Russia get to sit on the Human Rights Council and we would continue in the meantime to watch atrocities and horrors like what happened in Bucha happen again and again? She said they don't need to use the Human Rights Council as a propaganda platform for their narrative.
That's VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Beshear. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm VOA Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman. Joining us now on Flashpoint Ukraine is Aparna Pandey, the director of the Hudson Institute's Initiative on the Future of India and South Asia, and author of the book Making India Great, The Promise of a Reluctant Global Power. Aparna, India finds itself in a delicate position. It just rolled out the red carpet for the Russian foreign minister at a time where Sergei Lavrov and the Kremlin are being heavily criticized elsewhere in the world for the Russian invasion of Ukraine. What's going on between Moscow and New Delhi?
India's relationship with Russia is strategic and based on geography. There's a historical dimension going back to the Cold War and the Soviet Union. But India's primary concern is China. And with China sitting on the Indian border and a close China-Pakistan nexus, India wants Russia to keep India's interests in mind. This means supporting India against China. This means ensuring that the Indian military continues to receive spare parts and supplies. We must remember that 70% of India's military arsenal is Russian/Soviet made, and India still remains one of the largest importers of Russian equipment. That explains why Sergei Lavrov was in India. That explains why India's vote on the UN Security Council and the UN General Assembly has not been the same as votes by America and American allies.
You mentioned these close, long-standing ties between India and Russia, but the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi has continued to draw closer to Washington under U.S. President Donald Trump and maintaining that with the current administration of President Joe Biden. That seems to have put Modi's government in a position to face some criticism now from the U.S. National Security Council, the State Department, and even Biden himself. What are you hearing about how Washington wants to navigate its relationship with the world's largest democracy amid the war between Russia and Ukraine?
Steve, I think a statement which was made recently by the White House was that India's response was unsatisfactory but unsurprising. I think Washington knows fully well and understood fully well what New Delhi would do. And anybody who follows India foreign policy would not have been surprised. I'm sure you weren't surprised either. Yes, India and the United States have built a very strong and deep partnership over the last two decades, I would say. Every American president has visited India. Every Indian prime minister visited the US a couple of times. But the strategic alignment, we must remember, is the Indo-Pacific. The Indo-Pacific, from India's context, is a maritime. It does not deal with India's threats on the continental landmass. And so from India's point of view, Indo-Pacific, India does not have concerns when it comes to China and the Indian Ocean and Pacific. India's concerns on the landmass are not treated by the Indo-Pacific strategy. And there, India still needs to be worried about what happens on the 2,000-mile-long border with China and what happens on the border with Pakistan. And there, Russia's role becomes important and critical.
Do you have any expectation that the evidence of the massacres at Bucha blamed on Russian troops will compel India to openly condemn Russia in a way that we've not seen until now?
I hope it does, but I'm not sure it will. What I have seen is that Indian television channels, which till recently were quite critical of US policy and were seemingly sympathetic, many of them, to Russia. The recent massacre in Bucha and the photographs have been shown, and there are many channels which are referring to it as genocide. But I don't know if the change in public sympathy and in television news channels and television hosts' views will make a difference to what New Delhi will do at the UN Security Council or what it will say openly.
Thank you, Aparna Pandey of the Hudson Institute, for joining us on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine.
Thank you, Steve. It was a pleasure to be with you.
12 days before Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February, President Joe Biden urged all U.S. citizens staying or living in Ukraine to immediately leave the country. And though many have, other Americans remain in Ukraine and have no plans to leave. Anna Kostuschenko has the story.
Hey, Irina, it's Rachel.
I finally was able to find two generators available for these troops in Slovansk that I've been trying to get. So I'm like super happy to...
Rachel McVeigh makes more than 30 calls just like this one every day. She's one of the many American volunteers who decided to stay in Ukraine after Russia's invasion and help.
It's encouraging to see how everybody is coming together, and it's not a situation where anybody just says, okay, Army, you do your thing, you provide for yourself. Like, this is all personal for each one of us.
For Rachel, the morning of February 24th started with a call from her parents in the United States. They told their daughter Putin had invaded Ukraine, and the Russian military started bombing several Ukrainian cities at once. Among them was the capital, Kyiv, where Rachel had been living for 6 years and where she worked as a copywriter.
One day you have your city, you have your life, you're sitting and drinking coffee with friends and thinking about your career plans, and then the next day you're on your phone and you're getting updates like enemy paratroopers have landed outside of the city.
She had the means to immediately return to her parents in Philadelphia, but she didn't.
On the first day of war, I had a friend who was already in Lviv. Her and her husband were driving out of the city. They were driving to Poland by car, and they offered to take me with them.
Rachel had her reasons to stay in Ukraine.
Ukraine to me is freedom, where I found myself. It's where I found friends that I truly love and connect with. It's where I found love.
American Charles Bonds also arrived in Lviv with just a small backpack. Bonds is a historian who decided himself to study in Stalinism. He came to Ukraine from Indiana on February 1st, planning to settle and teach in Ukraine.
On the 24th of February, I woke up, went out to smoke a cigarette, and on the general balcony of the apartment, I saw people with suitcases. And I realized what was going on almost immediately, that the war had started.
Bonds and his American colleagues left for Lviv on the first days of the invasion, but he didn't leave Ukraine.
We're appealing to America to raise funds. We are purchasing necessary tactical items and humanitarian items, tactical items.
Bonds believes Ukraine will emerge from this conflict victorious.
In two decades, Ukraine will be the most powerful nation in Europe. I have every faith in that. And people may laugh at me, but they laughed at people who predicted the fall of the Soviet Union.
Bonds, like many others, is convinced Ukraine will win. And nothing, even Russia's invasion, can make him leave the country he has come to love. Anna Kostyuchenko for Voice of American Youth, Lviv, Ukraine.
Multimedia art galleries in the United States and Canada are showing a special exhibit highlighting the work of the 19th century Ukrainian artist and poet Taras Shevchenko. It is part of a fundraising effort to support Ukrainians displaced by the Russian invasion. Svetlana Pristinska has our story from the Rocky Mountain state of Colorado.
Produced by the multimedia art company Lighthouse Immersive, the show presents paintings and illustrations by the Ukrainian writer, artist, and political activist Taras Shevchenko, who lived from 1814 to 1861. It is modeled on the company's popular Immersive Van Gogh and Immersive Frida Kahlo exhibits and was designed by associate producer Valery Kostyuk. Creative consultant Richard Ozonian recalls Kostyuk bringing the immersive Shevchenko idea to the Lighthouse management.
And we went, who? Because, of course, if you're not Ukrainian, you don't know him. And he told us, and we went, this sounds wonderful. So we gave him the time off from work. We all said, take the ideas you've learned here. And he went back to Ukraine and with colleagues over there put this show together, and it was an enormous success.
Following Russia's invasion, Ozonian says the Lighthouse team knew they needed to do something.
Horrible things happened, and one of their first thoughts was, we must do something for the people of Ukraine. One of our employees has already done a beautiful tribute to one of the greatest artists in Ukraine's history. Why don't we show it?
All proceeds from ticket sales will benefit two charities that are helping Ukraine, including the Red Cross and the National Bank of Ukraine Fund. In addition to the fundraising, Ozonian says the company hopes to increase appreciation for Ukrainian cultural hero, renowned for resisting Russian oppression of his country in the 19th century.
One of the things that will touch anyone in the world the most is probably the most famous painting and poem that Shevchenko did, which is Katrina. And it's the story of a young Ukrainian girl who has an affair with a Russian occupying soldier, and he gets her pregnant and he leaves her, and her family disowns her, and she is so depressed she makes sure her son will be taken care of, and then she commits suicide. And it puts a face on what happens to a country when people come in and impose their will on it and try to change them and use them.
Ozonian says Shevchenko's resilience against Russian oppression is relevant in today's conflict.
When you see this exhibit new, you'll see how this beautiful young man, at the age of 47, he looks like he's 77 because he was so worn out. But he came back from 10 years in Siberia and would not let that destroy him. He said, Ukrainians must always fight and be free. That's our message. We're proud to help spread it.
The Immersive Shevchenko benefit is showing at Lighthouse Galleries in Boston, Chicago, Denver, Los Angeles, Toronto, and San Francisco. Svetlana Pristinska for VOA News, Denver, Colorado.
That's our show for today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world, 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on our social media platforms, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Chief National Correspondent, Steve Herman. Good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.